What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about board games. I'm your co-host, Mark Bigney, and with me is the better half of So Very Wrong About Games, Michael Walker. How you doing, Walker?
I'm doing very well, Mark. How are you?
I'm doing very well as well. We don't have time, Walker.
No time.
No time for chit-chat. So many games. We're going to talk about the games we played last week. We're going to talk about the news and why it doesn't matter. And then our feature game, which is Undaunted 2200 Callisto by Trevor Benjamin and David Thompson. But we have just enough time to say happy Thanksgiving to our Canadian listeners. Moving on. Walker, what did you play last week?
Mark, you and I got to play Black Forest. This is the newest Uwe Rosenberg game that he did with Tito Lorenz. Apparently it is the successor to Glass Road. I've not played Glass Road recently, so I can't do any exact comparisons, but from what I've read and watched, it takes out the action cards. In Glass Road, you'd play action cards, you'd be rewarded if you could figure out what other players were playing and match their cards, but that's right out. Now we're moving around to different villages, taking townspeople actions, and it was enjoyed by all. It has the same sort of very interesting mechanisms where your glassmakers really want to make glass. So you track your resources on this wheel. So it's very hard to explain audibly, but I'll try my best. You have this wheel that has resources, and as soon as you move the resources to a certain threshold, the glass is automatically made, and it turns the dial, thereby reducing all of your resources by one, but increasing your glass by one or two.
It is a mechanical way to simplify what could have otherwise been a tedious process of reducing five different resources by one to increment a different resource up by one. Works the same way for glass as it does for provisions and commodities. You have two separate resource wheels, and so it's operating on these two parallel tracks.
And for the provisions, you just simply use those to move around the town because it's very expensive, because no matter how far you move, you're spending provisions unless you stay within the same town. And commodities is an interesting sort of mechanism.
Is it, though?
Well, you can use it to sort of stall your wheel or speed your wheel, because sometimes you might want to do either. And sometimes there are actions that you don't want to do. There's one act, because when you go into a town, you're going to go in between two townspeople, and you get to do both of those actions. But sometimes one of the actions is not to your liking or not optimal, because you'll get resources that you don't need, or you're maxed out on, or you're going to lose a forest that you might want. So you can use a commodity to bring the townsperson in and switch it with that tile. And that just gets you two of a resource that you might really need. It gives the other people one of that resource, but, you know, sometimes you have to take the penalty. And then you do the one action that you do want. So I do feel as though, maybe not so much in the game that we played, but in the second game, I felt as though that it was used a bit more optimally.
I spent much of my time spending commodities merely so as to allow my wheel to advance. And so I didn't think that it was of a special use. Now, granted, maybe, as you say, it was because I was playing suboptimally, or maybe in a different configuration it would be more consequential. It just seems like it was a bit of a rough edge in a game that's otherwise reasonably clean. In Black Forest, it's mostly about you make the glass so you can build the buildings, and then you make the glass so you can build the buildings, and you make the glass so you can build the buildings, which is fine. I'm not saying it's overly simplistic. And the provisions make sense. Sometimes you need them a lot, sometimes you don't. The commodities were the only ones where it's like, eh. And so while I was struggling for all the other resources in various satisfying Euro ways, the commodities just struck me as a gamey contrivance that I had to spend merely so as to be able to advance. Minor correction on Glass Road. It's a game where you get better actions if you don't match other players, as opposed to do matching. But I always felt that the action cards in Glass Road were kind of the weakest element. And so I very, very much appreciate the change from that action card selection mechanism to a vaguely almost worker placement, not really vaguely rondel, not really situation. It's not particularly in-depth or interesting, but it gets the job done. It's perfectly serviceable. And Glass Road is a game about bottlenecks. You're always facing these series of bottlenecks. Oh, I would kill for some more sand. Oh, now I desperately need some more water. Oh, now I would love to be able to get some more meat. And I was actually quite surprised by how few instances there are of getting those specific resources. It's not like a lot of contemporary Euros where there's a wash of action spaces, even comparing it to Uwe Rosenberg's other excellent work, such as A Feast for Odin. If you need something in A Feast for Odin, usually there's two or three different kinds of action spaces that can get you there. Not so much in Black Forest, and that was interesting.
Yeah, my two games were so different. I thought it was so weird. Because, I don't know if you remember in our game, I had so many you have this little glass chart, glass track. Every time you get to the maximum, you add on a little sideboard, so your little domain keeps getting bigger.
Yeah, and your thematic explanation for what that represents was kind of cool. As the glassmakers exploit their local resources and develop the local populace, because people get attracted to the glassmaking economic activity, eventually they run out and they're like, oh, time to leave, and then they leave, so they move on to the next territory, and the cycle keeps on going. I thought it was kind of cute.
Yeah, I like it. And so, I don't know if you remember, but I had a ton of those. In the second game I played, my glass bead didn't move a single space.
Oh, wow.
So it was this constant fight to try to fit everything on my main board, which was crazy. But it worked out. I didn't come first, but I was, you know.
You were in contention. You were reasonably competitive.
It was all pretty close in that second game. We streamed it. You can check it out.
Well, it's the same sort of territory management that Uwe Rosenberg has been iterating and reiterating on ever since Farmers of the Moor. You have these forests in Black Forest. You have these sand pits as well as these lakes. And sometimes you want lots of them, but they take up space. And sometimes you remove them for resources. And sometimes you're happy to do that. And sometimes you're populated, et cetera, et cetera. And it's a push and pull that he's been fiddling with forever. And this, of course, is perhaps the most accurate and the biggest praise and the biggest criticism one can offer of Black Forest. It is the next Uwe Rosenberg Euro management game. And he just has these set of ideas that he keeps combining and recombining. I was happy to play it. I enjoyed it. Uwe Rosenberg makes very, very good instances of this iteration. But if you told me, is this something to move me off of my settled favorites like Agricola Hallertau and Feast for Odin? To me, the answer is no. Somehow he manages to avoid feeling too derivative, but it is absolutely derivative. It's hugely derivative of his past works, among them Glass Road, among them half a dozen of his other Euros. The most striking thing about Uwe Rosenberg, though, I just want to introduce as an aside, is that prior to Agricola, he was the guy who did Bargain Hunter and Bonanza. He was the small card game, small box card game guy. And now, ever since he published Agricola, he's the medium-weight Euro farming guy. It's amazing. I can't think of another career that has had such a radical and sharp demarcation in terms of it's wild.
Well, I think it's very much more approachable than an Agricola. But it does fall into the same problem as Caverna does, where you have this two boards of 36 buildings that all do something different. They're very nicely broken down into how much they cost and what they're sort of used for. So that at least that part is good, but still lots for the first play to sort of figure out. And, you know, the main board takes up so much space. So a lot of people aren't even going to be able to see half the buildings. So there's this lot of looking around. Issue. There's large buildings as well. But anyway.
I do agree with you that the information presentation is pretty good because, as I say, this is a game a lot about bottlenecks. And so you're struggling for that run resource. You find you're really not in a position to do it. So at the time you build the thing, it's like, oh, I don't do anything with sand. Oh, well, how much glass do I have? And what's the best sand building I can get? Let me just look at that row. Oh, that one lets me turn other things into sand. Let's go for it. And that, it makes things a lot easier. And the moment you have one or two resource pressures alleviated, then things accelerate considerably. Not to the point where you don't still feel strapped and starved for various other resources, but it makes a huge difference.
Yeah, it works in the opposite way as well. It's like, oh, I'm producing all this water, and I you know, I need to spend more water. Yeah. And you look over there, it's like, well, there's the water row. I could spend water to do that. And I love the water space because you get a water for every pool that you have. But that exact same space is spending clay to get another pool. So you always have to decide,
yeah,
do I want to have more capacity to generate water or do I need water now? And it's, I love it.
Yeah, so it's very well done. If you're a fan of Uwe Rosenberg's work, it's worth checking out. It is not, however, I think, one of his best. And if you are the kind of, what's the word for this? I suppose sane, responsible gamer that thinks that you can make do with, I don't know, maybe 500 games in your collection, an insanely low number. I don't know how anyone survives at that level. Then Black Forest is not going to show you anything you haven't seen before in other Uwe Rosenbergs.
That's Black Forest. Let's just cover Bargain Hunter since we brought
it up.
Let's
just go straight on into Bargain Hunter, straight on through to the other side. Try to run, try to hide.
Played a nice four-player game of this, and this is a great sort of set collection, I guess, trick-taking.
Not really.
Well, you're collecting sets of numbers.
I guess. Set collection.
It's more trick-taking, I suppose you could say. And you you look at your hand at the beginning of the game, and you pick a number, and this is the number you're trying to collect. So you're trying to win tricks that have that number. And while you're doing this, you're sort of keeping track of the other cards and those tricks that you're winning, because eventually you want to turn into a different number. So you're going to look at your junk pile and say, well, I want a bunch of sevens, so I think I've got as many threes as I can get. I'm going to switch to sevens now. And when that opportunity comes, you discard two of them into the main discard, and the rest of the sevens can now be the top of your pile, and now you're trying to collect sevens. Or whatever.
Or three with three players. Yeah,
whatever that number.
Managing what is actually junk and what isn't junk is basically, I think, the heart of what's going on in Bargain Hunter. My favorite moment in terms of figuring out what other people are doing in Bargain Hunter is realizing, oh my, they just won like two sevens in that past trick, and they didn't seem too unhappy about it. Okay, they're actually scoring fives for now, but now I know they're also going after sevens. And that can influence what tricks you win, what tricks you lose. It also can influence what numbers you pivot to, because it's not really a good idea to try to pivot to a number that a whole bunch of other people are going after. And those are just some of the subtleties that I absolutely adore about Bargain Hunter. It is very straightforward when compared to a lot of the other gamerly hobbyist trick-taking games, especially those of the past few years. Not that any of them have been particularly cumbersome, but Bargain Hunter from 1998 is still my preferred trick taker of that version. It is slightly more player flexible than some trick takers. You can play with either three or four. I remember a day when trick taking games, you know, a lot of the traditional ones are definitely like this. You play with four, or you play with three, or you play with five.
It's competitive at four, period.
Right, exactly. Bargain Hunter is a little more flexible than that, although I do really appreciate the fact that some other hobbyist trick taking games, like Marshmallow Test, for example, can actually scale from three to five. Fancy that.
Anyway, yes, so like you said, it's an older game, and an older game that it matters what your throwaway cards are. A lot of trick-taking games, like, there's no way I can win this. I just need to get rid of some of these other cards so I have more power. But it matters, right? Because you got to look around and say, well, I can't throw away this three because he's trying to collect threes, and he's winning right now. So I love it. Anyway.
No, you're right. That is a dynamic. So often in trick-taking games, you don't care what you're playing, even when you have a choice. But you never are indifferent to what you're tossing away in Bargain Hunter. That's an excellent point.
Just so.
Bargain Hunter, Uwe Rosenberg, my edition of the Valley Games edition from 1998. I got to try a game called Unreliable Wizard. This is a solo game republished by Salt and Pepper Games. The artist and designer is Kamibayashi. And this is an old-style solo game of a style that I don't really like, in that you have this resource. In the case of Unreliable Wizard, it has kind of the trappings of a fantasy adventure of going to rescue a kingdom from the Demon Lord. And you have a resource, which is life points. And everything you do costs you life points. Costs you life points to move, costs you life points when you get attacked, costs you life points to play cards. And at that point, I just feel like I'm managing an accountant. I'm just managing this pool of resources. I don't feel like I'm doing a fantasy adventure. I don't think feel like I'm doing anything clever. The key gameplay conceit of Unreliable Wizard is you have these spells that you can cast that are basically the combination of abstract geometric shapes. And as you defeat monsters, you get more and more shapes available. So instead of just a basic spell, which is just the top shape, you can acquire the bottom side, and the bottom side by itself does nothing, but the bottom side in conjunction with the top side is a much better version of the spell. And then you can get the middle version, and if you can do all three, that's the best version of the spell. And so you're trying to create situations where you're going to maximize the odds of doing this. I wasn't quite able to internalize the probabilities behind Unreliable Wizard. I couldn't tell if there was something interesting there or not.
Probably because it's kind of unreliable.
Thanks, Walker. But ultimately, if you don't draw the top, you're never going to get anything. So you necessarily include the top, and then you only include the bottom if you're willing to take the risk, and you only include the middle if you're willing to accept a tremendous amount of risk. I don't know. I don't know if that's clever or just beyond my depth, but ultimately, I didn't really enjoy the prospect of this constant grinding attrition of getting from place to place. I felt like, as I said, I was more just managing the economics of my life points rather than actually engaging in anything past that. And so it was okay, I guess. I'm not particularly tempted to go back. As far as solo designs go, there are things that I would rather do. And as far as combat-y stuff, it never really felt like anything of that. And on top of that, it had a combat element that I very, very much don't like, in that the key trick that enemies exploit as you go up and up in level is their armor just gets higher and higher and higher and higher. And so you just feel like you're in a position where you have to overcome these incredibly high damage resistance ratings. And that's just a personal preference. I don't find that particularly enjoyable. I think it has to be finely balanced in order to do that. We played another game this week that I think does it much, much better. That's what we call a segue. Ladies and gentlemen, this is a professional level segue. So at the point where, your level 1 monster has 2 damage resistance and your level 3 monster has 5 damage resistance, okay, I guess I better only hit it with 6 or higher. And that further doubles down on just the random results of what you're pulling from your deck. I don't know. Didn't do it for me. Unreliable Wizard, more of an old style solo design, I think, from the early aughts rather than some of the sophistication and satisfying elements that you find in more recent stuff. Kamibayashi, Salt and Pepper Games, published this year.
Segue away, sir.
Well, the segue is that another game that sometimes results in managing armor values, but in a much better way, is Space Alert. We went back to Space Alert. I hadn't played it in a few years. I realized this because it was commented on by Josephus, who was in town, that Space Alert is something he hasn't done in a while. So naturally, we waited for him to leave so we could play it afterwards, so we could hear about it here, about how much a good time we had once he was gone.
Yes, well, obviously.
Friendship.
We don't want him to have fun.
Yeah.
That would be a travesty.
Space Alert is Vlada Kvatl's co-op game. This is Vlada Kvatl before Codenames. So back when he was designing weird Euro games with strange non-Euro elements. And this is a real-time cooperative game where, as Walker says, you put your pants in your head and you start running around like crazy, and then you find out afterwards that you lost. Normally, I don't like games where the scoring takes longer than the actual gameplay itself, and the game session itself is a timed 10-minute session. But you don't know what's going on during those 10 minutes, so the gradual process of unfolding and figuring out what on earth happened is pretty satisfying. I mentioned the armor values because some of the elements really do rely on their armor values in order to work. For example, we added an energy cloud, which has a very high armor rating unless it is hit by a very specific weapon on the ship at the time that it's within range, in which case its armor just reduces to 0. And so that element I very much enjoy, where there's ways to finagle the armor value rather than just brute force, instead of just scaling up to doing more and more damage. Gloomhaven did the same thing, for what it's worth. You'd encounter these enemies with like 2 or 3 hit points and a huge armor value. It's like, well, do you have pierce? Do you have a wound? Do you have poison? These are the things you can do, rather than just being like, well, I guess my numbers had better go up, which is a less interesting thing to do in my estimation.
For those who don't like Space Alert, it is a spaceship that has like a grid of 6, 3 on the top, 3 on the bottom, and everyone has a model there, and you're playing a bunch of programming cards, much like Robo Rally, that move you around the ship and hit buttons on the ship. And if you're both trying to use the lift at the same time, then you've messed each other's program up a little bit.
Or if you've used up someone's energy, you've gotten someone's way any other way. There's tons of ways.
Because all the guns take energy. So if you keep shooting, the weapon, it's going to run out of energy and no one's powered it up, even though they said they were going to power it up at turn 7. But now you're shooting and there's no power there.
Yeah, Dewey. Ugh. Way to power it up, Dewey.
And it's just not a matter of powering up. The main generator needs to produce energy, and then you need to transfer that energy into the 2 different sides of the ship. Anyway, all the weapons do different damage, and like Mark said, you have to like sort of figure out as these threats slowly come down, and they appear in different times, because you have like a 12-turn timer, and it'll say, comes in at turn 6. So if you're like firing, turns 1 through 5 at the center because you think this thing's coming down the center, it hasn't even shown up yet. So you got to sort of time it out right. It's very interesting, super fun. I will play it anytime. One of my favorite games, Space Alert.
A couple of things I just want to mention in terms of sort of a retrospective of Space Alert, where it was in the market at the time. I remember when it was released, this was only a few years after Pandemic, mind you. And I remember that for a time, it was like the most complicated co-op that anyone had ever played. I remember at the time also, it was the kind of thing where it's like you do have to do the staged intro tutorials because the prospect of having all these different kinds of actions you could do in real time was just too overwhelming. No, I meant that sincerely. We were like hardcore hobbyist gamers. We'd been in the hobby for over a decade. We're like, all right, everyone's got to take the tutorial, guys. Now, we're so accustomed to so much more complexity. We just jump right in, no problem, teach everybody right up. Also, 2 years after it was released, the expansion Space Alert was released, and it was like the only campaign system that anyone had done in the hobby for a very long time. And so we all descended on it like rabid jackals and we campaigned like crazy. And now everything's got a campaign. It's just an interesting sort of time capsule in that sense.
And we have to talk about what the hilarity of Space Alert. There is something that you have to do every round. You're sort of divided into three segments and your ship is run by a main computer. And if you don't jiggle the mouse,
The screensaver cuts in. The lights go out, and everyone is delayed a turn.
So yeah, everyone has to make sure that during each phase that the mouse gets jiggled so the main computer doesn't shut down. Love it. Anyway.
This is on top of the fact that the rule book is probably one of the funniest I've ever read. I prefer it.
Yes.
Vlada Kavadl is known for a good, funny rule book, but I think the Space Alert one takes the cake,
yes,
frankly.
Space Alert and Dungeon Lords, both fantastic reads as rule books. And there's also internal threats. Things are launching themselves in your, you also have aliens, you know, rampaging through the inside of your ship as well. You're controlling robots, you're firing missiles. It's awesome.
Space Alert.
We also got Wabash Cannonball back to the table. This is a cube rails game and you're buying stocks and you're developing your railroads. You're trying to get to, we thought it was Detroit at first, but it turned out it was Chicago. And in the game we played before this one, we never even got to Chicago. This time there was multiple tracks that got to Chicago.
Two railroads, yeah.
So it played much differently. Very interesting. You're sort of manipulating the market. And I was wondering, I was thinking about it yesterday, I was wondering if you could like totally like sort of dead name a rail. What if someone opened up? Then I realized that there's a minimum bid, but it would still really hurt that railroad if someone like opened up minimum bid and then no one else bid on it. And then they only get $5 into the coffer. And so they won't be able to advance their tracks much because they only have the $5 to work with. And if every time that railroad came up, no one bid except for the first person, then you could sort of hinder that railroad, I think.
It's possible. There are, in some ways, it's a good problem to have. Say blue opens up and nobody bids up blue and blue never goes anywhere. Well, that's $5 a round. The owner's just going to pocket and they're never going to have to bother to do anything with their actions to protect their investment in blue or worry about it. The bigger problem actually is when a railroad has multiple outstanding shares and is undercapitalized. If a bunch of shares get purchased, typically two or three by different players, and there's not enough money in the coffers, that's when a railroad ends up being a real stinker because your share is not going to be giving you $5, $6, $7 a round. It's going to be giving you $2 or $3 a round and it can't go anywhere. That's when it's dead. Truly dead. And that's where you end up in situations, particularly when the Wabash opens. The Wabash Cannonball is a railroad that will only open if somebody hits Chicago. And that's why people start calculating very carefully how much money to put into the coffers. Because it typically opens up on the last round or the penultimate round. And you might figure, oh, well, underbid it. It's not, well, there's got to be enough cash for it to do something. So if you're going to bid, there are certain bids that are just flatly wrong. $1 is always fine because it's going to pay out $1. $5 for the Wabash Cannonball, bad bid. Just not a good idea, flatly. At that point, you need to bid it up higher so it can hit Chicago. It's a whole thing. And as you say, the economy develops. For me, it's less the board position, more the economy that I find interesting in terms of Wabash Cannonball. Yes, they're both very variable. In this case, I bought 2 shares of stock only. I bought them only on the first round, never bought anything else, and I did quite well, which was great. Because sometimes you need a diversified portfolio. This time, no, just had 2 red shares. Somebody else had the 3rd share. That was the aforementioned Josephus. Rather than looking at me and saying, you know what, the two of us, we can make something worthwhile. We can build something of value. He said, nah, I'm just going to run this railroad straight off a cliff. And he did. And it wasn't great.
And it still didn't affect you.
No, it affected me very much. I would have. See, the thing is, it's an interesting question, both in terms of the board state and in terms of player preference, right? If somebody else has the majority shareholder of a railroad, red is easiest because it has the fewest number of outstanding shares. So this situation, this sort of equilibrium kicks in earlier and more often. But if somebody else is in a settled position, it's a maximally capitalized railroad and somebody else has more, you want the railroad to do well if on unless you think you're headed for second and or you think the other person's headed for first. In other cases, you're more than happy for it to profit somebody else more because the two of you are gaining on everybody else. But Josephus looked at the board and said, I think Mark's going to win, or I think Mark is going to do better than me. I don't want Red to do well. I'm going to focus on the other railroads and hope that they propel me to first place. In other contexts, it makes perfect sense to cooperate and have something hit Chicago. I think that in the groups that I play, this is probably because of how cutthroat everyone is, they seldom look at the board and say, I think we can benefit in cooperation. Normally it's like, no, tank it. But it was just, I can't remember the last time someone was able to remain competitive in Wabash Cannonball without buying more than two shares and more than two shares at the start of the game. It was a little strange.
I think that's what makes Wabash so great. There's so many mechanisms that are really good. Like you said, each of the railroads has a different number of shares, so that's really going to change up the game. And the action selection, I think, is fantastic. There's only three actions you can do when it's your turn, but there's a limited number of those actions per round. And once they're used up, then you don't get to do that action anymore. You have to do one of the other actions, but they're all so important that you're just not sure what to do. Should I do this now in case, you know, everybody else chooses that and we can't do it anymore? And because once two of them get to the end of that track, then that round will end. Anyway, love Wabash Cannonball.
We played the new, hideously ugly, but nonetheless charming Rio Grande version from 2023. I'm glad that there is an affordable, small, readily available version now, designed by John Borer initially, and it has had several different versions, including Chicago Express by Queen. So if you want to pay three times as much and get something five times as big, it's available. Played Quartermaster General 1914 Second Edition. So the original edition of Quartermaster General 1914 was published by PSC Games. The second edition was published by Ares Games. The big change in terms of components, as you might imagine, the Plastic Soldier Company produced a copy of the game with plastic soldiers in it. Shocker, I know. Whereas the Ares Games version has only wood. There have been some card changes, but frankly, all told, the changes are negligible.
I think there needs to be a little sort of like a flow of a little imagination maybe for these companies. You know, we have a company that makes little plastic soldiers called Plastic Soldier Company. And then we have a company that makes little plastic trains called the Little Train Company.
Maybe, I love the Little Plastic Train Company.
Maybe a little more imagination there. Maybe, you know, go out on a limb and call it something.
I disagree.
They sort of pigeonholed themselves, didn't they, on what, you know.
Sometimes the title just presents itself. Like the week where you're voting on Fat Bears, Fat Bear Week. A podcast where people are very wrong about games, there you go. Sometimes the name just presents itself.
There you go.
So Quartermaster General 1914 was the third game in the series, and the Quartermaster General series has always been a very light, somewhat historically evocative, team-based game system, with the possible exception of some of the later entries like Cold War, which is three players, Free for All, and East Front, which is just two players. But before that, we have the four-player Peloponnesian War version in two teams of two. We've got the Quartermaster General OG, which was two teams of three against each other in World War II. The World War I version, though, I think is fascinating for a number of reasons. One of them is that the teams are asymmetric. You have the Central Powers, which consist of two players, one of them the Austro-Hungarians and the Ottomans, and the other player being the Germans, against a team of three players. And most games that I've tried that try to do that asymmetric team thing fall apart. But I really do think that the card balancing in Quartermaster General 1914 does a fabulous job of keeping things tight. And each nation kind of has its role in the overall coalition. Now, this can change from game to game. The way the setups alter and the way different player choices can lead to different map compositions can indeed encourage various players to do various things and to emphasize different actions. But nonetheless, it is nice to have a team-based game where you really feel like the team's roles are somewhat delineated, even though at times you're going to need everyone to pull their own weight in various ways. This was a bit of a nail-biter. We went to the last round, and it was a tie. We had to resort to the tiebreaker because in the middle game, the Germans occupied Paris. But then they ran out of steam hardcore. The supply issues in Quartermaster General games are huge, and you will run out of cards if people start targeting you. And Germany was very much targeted by economic warfare cards, and consequently they were driven out of Paris. The Entente Cordiale retook Paris, and they retook Picardy. It was a whole thing. Germany was very much in decline by the end. And the Russians didn't even exit the war. There are so many lovely little historical elements in the Quartermaster General games. One of them is that in the Quartermaster General 1914, the Russians can literally exit the war. They remove most of their pieces from outside Russia, scoring a whole bunch of points in the process. And they just say, nah, we're done. No more. It's so well done. It is my favorite of the series. It's really hard to get to the table. I've been wanting to try the second edition for a long time. I was, I guess, somewhat disappointed and pleased that barely anything had changed. So if you've got your first edition of Quartermaster General 1914, hold on to it. If you want to get the game, it is now back in print. And I am a huge fan of the way that it is light, but nonetheless historically evocative. That is Quartermaster General 1914, designed by Ian Brody. Published both by PSE and later by Ares Games, this edition from 2022.
I got to have Lunar Rush back to the table. This is designed by Stephen Skippy Brown and put out by Dead Alive Games. Now, I love Lunar Rush because I'm going to compare it to Undaunted here, because at the beginning of the round, you have to bid for initiative, much like you do in Undaunted. And you need to get, you need to win because you're shipping goods up to the moon. And depending on where you go, you're going to get either a fast ship, a medium ship, or a slow ship. It's going to take, you're going to get the goods this round, in two rounds, or in three rounds. But three rounds, you get nine, medium, you get three, and if you want this turn, you're only going to get one good. It's like sort of carrying capacity. But you're bidding victory points, so it's this very odd system where you're deciding how many victory points am I going to pay in order to, you know, get the ship I want. And it gets even more and more expensive as the turns go by. The interesting part is that all the goods that you load onto these ships are free. So you just load the ships up to capacity with whatever goods you want. And workers, because once you get to the next phase, it's sort of a worker placement, work your engine thing. So you start with three up on the moon and you have to get more up there. But you got to make sure there's places for them to live and air for them to breathe. And then you start working these engines. The reason we got it back to the table is that it's going to be coming out with an expansion early next year where everyone has asymmetric powers. So there's going to be robots and scientists and all sorts of different things which completely change up how each one plays. The robots, you don't need any life support. All you need is the energy to power them. And they have 20 workers that they have ability to get up there. So you just, you know, start loading all your all your ships up with all these robots that come up. You need to power them. But anyway, love Lunar Rush because you get to upgrade all your buildings. I love that sort of thing, how you get to, you know, manipulate your tableau and start upgrading buildings so they produce more stuff faster. And then not only are you bidding to get the ships to bring stuff up, you also need to bring the stuff back down to Earth because that's how you're scoring your victory points. And it's the same sort of system. You know, slow ships, you get to load a lot on, but they're not going to get there for three turns. Quick ships go fast. And then there's the order because it's a fluctuating market like any other games. The more you sell, the cheaper it'll get. But although there are different sheets you can use for different games and they change how the market works. But that being said, they all usually roughly work the same sort of way. Love Lunar Rush. So glad I got to play it again. Looking forward to this expansion.
Yeah, I've been meaning to play it again because I like the core mechanisms. I just didn't find it particularly engaging in terms of what you were building towards. But that, I understand, was an aberrant session, and very often those gold modules are very, very worthwhile.
Yeah, the games I played after that, went kind of crazy on the gold modules, and they really do change up the game. You have like one opportunity at the beginning. After your ships move up, you have one opportunity to buy one of these like super special gold things. They even have some cooperative ones where the person that builds it gets something automatically. And that sort of set the tone of my game. There was one that gives you five life support automatically at the beginning of every round. And because you're the robots, that just turns into energy. So sort of my energy was sort of being taken care of, but everyone else can actually use that building.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, it was kind of neat. This was played on TTS, but yes, we were sent a review copy of Lunar Rush.
Played a game called Cross Clues. This is one more cooperative word-based game. This was designed by Grégory Jard, published by Blue Orange Games in 2020. The way that it works is there's a grid of 25, five rows, five columns. Each row and column has a word attached to it. And so every node in the 25-point grid is the intersection of two words. For example, one that caused considerable consternation was fire and cat. And what you do is in real time, you're pulling these intersections. You're pulling a specific combination of these two words that is randomized from game to game, and you have to come up with a one-word clue that will get people to guess it. So far, it is resembling superficially in a number of ways just one, in that it's a one-word clue, you're trying to make associations, it's cooperative. I wasn't a huge fan of Cross Clues because I really felt that it was leaning into some of the less interesting parts of, say, some of those latter rounds of code names, for example. You know, you've got these two words that really aren't connected to each other at all. You have to come up with a clue somehow that links them, and you're racking your brain for these two random things to be associated somehow, and you're just doing that part over and over and over again. You're not trying to make any sort of social inferences like you are in Just One. You're not trying to make any conceptual linkages like you might do in some of the earlier rounds of Codenames, where it's like, okay, I've got this list of 9 words. Can I really think of a good way to combine 3 or even 4, maybe even 5 of them together? Those are the parts that I find more interesting in those games. Cross Clues, you're just getting 2 random words together, trying to link them with a third as a clue over and over again. And so I felt like there was less variety. It felt repetitious, even at the early bits. And I didn't find coming up with the clues to be particularly interesting. And people are just stumped a lot of the time, frankly. And so I'd much rather play something like Just One or Codenames, frankly. When it comes to these word-based co-op games, you're spoiled for choice lately. And so whether it's So Clover, whether it's even a team-based something like Decrypto, Cross Clues wouldn't
Word
rank.
Traveler.
Word Traveler. I don't think Cross Clues would rank for me. I thought the basic idea was perhaps clever in terms of coming up with the things that you're trying to clue off of, but the actual mechanisms of cluing off didn't do anything
for me. Was it a bit like Mysterium, where you had to play something, so even if you didn't have a word that was any good at all, you still had to play something?
It's not a question of playing, it's giving a clue. You're randomly given the connection between two clues, and you have to fill out the entire grid cooperatively, and so you're going to get every connection together. Now, I mean, later, the only interesting part of Cross Clues that it added was you eventually get to the process of elimination, right? You see the clues that have been successfully done. A clue comes up and says, well, my normal inclination would be to link shovel and camping, but in this context, we already see that node has been connected, so I guess we'll have to find a different combination. That part wasn't bad, but as I say, there are a whole bunch of other games that I'd rather play over Cross Clues. Tried Avatar The Last Airbender, Aang's Destiny. So this is the redevelopment of the co-op deck-building game that was originally themed about Harry Potter. I'm not really into Harry Potter. I was never into Harry Potter, and now I'm even less into Harry Potter for reasons perhaps obvious to those in the know. And it was always regarded as way too easy. I remember the common wisdom about the Harry Potter deck-building game was, Hogwarts Battles, was that when you got to the later scenarios, with the expansion, it became vaguely challenging. It's like, okay, that sounds like way too much buildup. But then when it was rethemed and slightly redeveloped around Avatar The Last Airbender, I thought, this is something that Walker would be interested in. I asked him, Walker, do you want to try this game? He's like, I'll try it, maybe. And then he tried it and was super into it.
Maybe a little exaggeration.
That is exactly what happened. You got caught. You played up like Appa for the game. You started shedding everywhere. I don't know how that worked.
I said, we're playing again right now. You guys said no. Yeah. I said, then get the F out.
Yeah, that's more or less what happened.
There's no solo mode, but I played, you know, five-handed myself.
There is a solo mode.
Oh, okay, sorry. Or I played solo myself for the
next. If you're going to do a bit, make sure it's accurate, Walker. We don't want our bits to mislead people.
Yeah, sorry.
So what did you think of The Last Airbender?
I thought it was great. And I like the fact it sort of brings you through the episodes as well. I'm sure that's what Hogwarts did as well, brought you through the movie. But
not really, actually. One of the complaints is, one of the redevelopments of The Last Airbender version is you do actually have new enemy decks to represent the fact that you're not fighting the same people the entire series long.
Gotcha. Well, this first one sort of brought you through the first episode anyway.
Yeah.
And it looked as though, you know, it was slowly going to introduce more, you know, states, more elements. And it sort of did the water one first. And then so that, well, obviously they're going to do earth and other ones later.
Well, they introduced other characters that show up later. Yeah. And so because there are 2 different kinds of cards, there are the normal cards that anyone can buy and use. And then there are the bending cards, which anyone can buy, but non-benders use them much less well. And at the start of the game, you only have wind and water bending cards because you only have 2 benders. And that those are the only things that they know how to bend. But later on, you're going to get earth and fire bending cards and earth and fire benders. And so it will gradually expand. In that way, it's a 7 different boxes. It's a 7 scenario game, and that's how it works.
And I like how everyone's deck is different. Everyone plays a different character, and the cards work a different way for them, and their starting decks are different. You can actually play Appa, and he has like all sorts of, you know, group helping abilities and travel abilities. So I like how they're themed towards the actual character. Sokka can't use any of the bending parts of the cards. You can only use the melee parts. Anyway, I enjoyed it. I am looking forward to playing again.
It did seem very easy.
It did, yes.
I think it was very accurately described by Josephus as Baby's first deck builder. And that's reasonably accurate, especially as far as co-op goes. I mean, the co-op elements were pretty straightforward. An enemy shows up, it does something to you, you have to do damage to it to progress to the next enemy. So not a whole lot of triage. You know, you generate the resources and they go to an obvious place. All that having been said, number one, I find mediocre deck builders to be generally perfectly engaging. I'm very happy to play them, even if there's not really reason to go back to them or recommend them. I just find something about the structure to be very satisfying. And also, I think it did a reasonably good job of being thematically evocative and narratively evocative of the early episodes of Avatar the Last Airbender. Now, whether this is going to persist into future boxes, whether they are going to feel more like later parts of the show, I don't know. And just as a note, for those of you that are interested in us rambling incoherently about Avatar the Last Airbender, we have 3 episodes of Masterpiece Theater talking about the 3 seasons of Avatar the Last Airbender. We also have 4 episodes of us talking about The Legend of Korra, which consists of 1 episode of us talking great things about Korra, and then 3 episodes about my ranting with a fiery rage about how they completely ruined any prospects or promise that the show had.
Ruined!
Yeah. I just want to stress, though, just for the record, I'm not angry about the very, 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 very end of Korra the way some retrogrades are. That part's fine. I don't mind. It's the other bits.
And I don't think the setup's overly egregious for what you get out of it. Like, it's not this huge setup for a cooperative sort of campaign-y type thing.
It's reasonably straightforward. It's in the boxes. You open up the box. Here's your stuff. Go to town. Yeah. Avatar The Last Airbender, Aang's Destiny, designed by Patrick Marino, published by the OP Games. Those are the games we played last week. Now we take a quick break to pay some bills.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
And we're back with the news and why it does not matter. Mark, come with me on another journey. Another.
No.
Yes, another post-apocalyptic journey.
Last time you made me sign a waiver and it was terrible.
There was tornadoes and vehicles.
I don't want this journey.
But now there's another really cool. Do you know of Howl's Moving Castle?
I am familiar with Howl's Moving Castle. Yes. I have not read the book, but I have seen the movie.
Let's pretend there is a giant city-sized type moving mech.
Okay.
Now it is just
mech. You say?
Let's say mech. Why not? Oh, no. Okay.
I feel like I'm being lied to now.
It's a quadruped. Well, wait.
Can have a quadrupedal mech.
I was about to say there. Okay. We'll call it a mech then. So you'll be interested. All right.
Does it transform?
No.
Oh, wow.
All right. So it's trundling along and you have to keep it. It gets damaged and stuff. It's trundling through a wasteland. Unfortunately, these mechanized zombie type things are crawling up the legs and infiltrating the ship.
Are they really mechanized zombies, or are you making that up?
I'm not.
Okay.
They're robot-y type zombies.
Okay.
All right. And so it's a cooperative sort of zombie killing, repairing the mech, picking up random salvage from the ground, because it has these claws that go down and just grab random stuff and bring them onto the ship, and you sort of have to use them as you see fit. So you're moving around this thing, you're killing the zombies, you're trying to stop them from destroying it. Sounds like it's going to be great. It's called The Waste of Parts.
The Waste of Parts?
Yes.
That could be strangely self-referential.
I know. It means so many things. Like, is this whole thing a waste of parts? Is this? Yes, it's great. I love it.
Your spare parts, aren't you, bud? Another reminder. On October the 27th, we will be celebrating Arkhipov Day in honor of Vasily Arkhipov, who saved the entire human race during the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Mark, we both love Talisman. It's quite the opposite.
Do we love Talisman in the same way that A Waste of Parts is a mech game?
Exactly.
Oh, boy.
Now, we hate Talisman for one reason. And they fix that.
So many lies.
So now we can play Talisman cooperatively.
Oh, boy.
There is a new cooperative expansion for Talisman, which will bring it back to the table for us, I am sure. Talisman Alliances, Fate Beckons. Man, wow. I have prepaid and I am waiting outside the printers so I can get that.
Walker, I don't know how, but somehow, over the course of the past few years, we have built up some degree of credibility with some people. Why are you so interested in setting this on fire and then walking away?
Because I find humor in it.
All right. So that is the news and why it doesn't matter. We now move on to our feature game. What's our feature game this week, Walker?
Undaunted 2200 Callisto.
This was designed by Trevor Benjamin and David Thompson, published by Osprey. This is a review copy sent to us by the publisher, although Walker did also buy his own copy. So, the Undaunted series started in 2019 with Undaunted Normandy, next year with Undaunted North Africa, then Undaunted Reinforcements, then Undaunted Stalingrad, then Undaunted Battle of Britain, and now every year we get a new Undaunted, this year with Undaunted 2200 Callisto, all of them designed by Trevor Benjamin and David Thompson, all of them published by Osprey. But Trevor Benjamin and David Thompson have also co-designed other games together, sometimes with other people, sometimes with just by themselves. For example, they co-designed General Orders, they co-designed Dire Alliance, possibly with the Sadler Brothers. I apologize for anyone who lost money down that particular rabbit hole, because Dire Alliance, I think, is now a myth. It's just some story they tell people to justify the fact that they ran off with our cash. They co-designed with Roger Tankersley the sadly underplayed by Mark Resist and Witchcraft. I don't have a retail copy of Witchcraft. I should really play more Witchcraft. It was so good. Trevor Benjamin co-designed Mandala with Brett Gilbert, which was also amazing. David Thompson by himself designed For What Remains and the Valiant Defense series. These are talented people.
Never
who have designed... Walker, why don't you give us an unhelpful summary about what one does in Undaunted 2200 Callisto?
You and your brothers and sisters of the Mining Guild have had enough. You're the ones that mine the ice. You're the ones that put your lives on the line day after day. And now they want to raise prices on that ice? The very ice you provide? That is enough. We've had enough.
Another way to frame the game is that these miners, who are completely unable to do any distribution, any manufacturing, any refinement, any commercial exploitation of these things, are completely bitter at the fact that other people put in their own labor to make any of this enterprise possible and want to run everything because they're power mad.
If you wanted to explain it the wrong way, that's fine.
Look, here's the thing, what people need to understand before we review more about Undaunted 2200 Callisto, is that Walker, especially when playing two-player games, I don't know why this is the case, especially with me, he decides who the good guys are and who the bad guys are, and he only will play the good guys and will never be willing to play the bad guys.
I was surprised that I wanted to play the Mining Guild. Honestly. I'm usually the one that stands up for the company. And the company ways and tries to justify
it's
what
true.
They're doing.
You are literally the most anti-organized labor person I know.
I think it was just like they seem like such the underdog. So I couldn't help myself.
And frankly, their character designs, all the character designs are amazing. I think that's one place to start, I guess. All the Undaunted artwork is done by Roland McDonald. This is no exception. And it's really cool. I like science fiction sort of near future, plausible future, tech-based operative kind of stuff. And just all the units look really neat, I think. The art has very different in style from the past Undaunted, which was kind of a soft focus, almost watercolor vibe in terms of the portraits of soldiers. And now, very appropriately, they've gone for a slightly more photorealistic sci-fi kind of comic edge.
All right, so I'm sure we're going to talk about the base Undaunted system later.
Well, we've talked about it a lot, frankly. I don't know how, like, we can go over it again.
Sure. I was just going to start with the setup. And some of the differences, but let's start with the setup. Setup, the game comes with these giant boards. So no longer do you have these tiles.
Yeah, quad-fold map boards. Yeah.
That you have to sort of piece together and I don't want to say like it was a huge deal, but you sort of have to rifle through all the...
It was a deal.
And I feel as though since they made these changes, they just wanted to alleviate some of the setup. So they've decided to make this decision where they're going to have the maps pre-done, and they have a lot of the stuff printed on the map as well, so you can quickly set things up, because a lot of the other things is a little daunting.
I can't believe you wanted to make that joke again. It was bad the first time, and now it's practically a crime against humanity.
I don't know what you're talking about.
So I'm of two minds with respect to the map boards. I'm not blind to the fact that it expedites setup and helps with both players being able to assist with setup. One person's holding the scenario book, the other person can just start setting up the map. But there are three problems I have with the fact that they use map boards rather than square tiles. Number one, I feel like it's a bit of a wasted opportunity because they're all grids after all. It's all just another way to do a grid. And so the square tiles and the maps get you to the same place. They didn't really exploit what they could have done making narrow passageways or choke points or weird hexagonal arrangements or something else. It's all just an offset square grid, which I suppose is very much like a hexagonal arrangement.
If you look at it, it looks like it's different, but they just sort of rounded off the edges. So it looks like it's sort of a mishmash of things, but it all works out the same as the original Undaunted.
The eighth scenario kind of gets you closer. But that actually leads me to my second objection. It increases the production costs and the weight of the game considerably. There are only 8 scenarios in Undaunted 2200. They can't release more through web scenarios or promo scenarios because every scenario has to be tied to a map. I guess they could reuse a map, but then that kind of defeats the object in the first place. And the third objection that I have to the maps is that there are misprints.
Yes. Fortunately, the scenario books are correct.
That is the good
Unfortunately,
news.
What they've printed on the maps themselves is wrong. So
there are two misprints.
Two of the maps are wrong, and some of the tokens are a little bit wonky in how they did it, because they have ones that say, you know, mechs vehicles can't move here, and there is a symbol in the rule book and on the maps that show that. On the tokens, unfortunately, it's a different symbol.
Yeah.
So that might lead to some confusion. So unfortunately, there's some misprints, but luckily they've been found and they're up there for people that know where to look for them.
Yes. So in terms of the Undaunted series more broadly, we've said it a number of times. I don't know if you've gone as far as I have. I think the Undaunted system uses the best initiative system of any game I've ever seen. You have a 4-card hand. Every card activates a unit, but also has an initiative value, and use the cards to bid for initiative. The reason why this is so painful and important is because better units and better cards have higher initiative. And if you lose initiative and you take a casualty to one of the units that you have in your hand, it goes straight out of your hand. And so your turn is less good than it could be otherwise. And so consequently, it always has teeth.
And I feel this is it's even more important in this particular system because it looks as though they've thrown you right into combat right at the beginning.
Yes.
It felt as though in the normal Undaunted, you're a little space away, is a little bit more about strategic moving at the very beginning. This one seems you're right in the firefight immediately. And a lot of the times you only have one of those cards in your deck. And how damage works is if you take a damage, you loot the other player and you had the initiative, that player loses that card out of their hand. And if they take another hit, then that unit will be taken off the board because they no longer have any of those cards in their hand or in their discard pile or in their deck. So at the beginning, and it just makes those first rounds very crucial. Do you gamble and attack, trying to eliminate those units immediately from your opponent? Or are you going to build up your own deck so it's not going to happen to you? So it's sort of this very interesting sort of risky maneuvers at the very beginning.
Okay, well, that trade-off I don't think really exists because they're generally speaking, with a couple of exceptions, you don't face the trade-off of using a card either for offense or for gathering more cards.
No, it meant for like the initiative. Like you could use that commander.
True.
And say, I'm going to use that commander for initiative because I want to, you know, attack right away and try to reduce that. Or I'm going to use that commander to bolster my deck so I don't get...
Well, that leads to one of my disappointments with Undaunted 2200, frankly, because it looks so neat and I love every other game from the series. I only like Undaunted 2200. I don't think it's a good entry point. I wouldn't recommend it over the other games in the Undaunted series. And one of the reasons why is I have now played most of the scenarios, not all of them, and they're meat grinders. That absence of strategic maneuver at the start means that almost right from the beginning, generally if any unit has moved, and sometimes not even if they haven't, because generally speaking your deployment areas are safe-ish, but the moment you go out and try to do anything like pursue victory objectives, you are immediately subject to withering fire. And the miners have access right from the start usually to a unit called the Nail Gunner, which allows them to throw 2 dice in attack. And for those of you that are accustomed to Undaunted, you know that that's a lot. And the corporation usually has access to mechs who can put down a very large number of dice, usually in suppression, sometimes also in attack. And so I feel that although the core combat system in Undaunted is great, but I much preferred the scenarios, especially the early scenarios, in the other Undaunted series, where it's like, okay, you have a few turns to set yourself up strategically, both in terms of maneuver and in terms of building your deck. In Undaunted 2200, a couple bad early shots, oh, that unit's gone. Forget about it. Your deck building opportunities for that unit are completely evaporated. And also, it just creates a tremendous focus on these high firepower units. It's not to my taste.
So what some of the changes they've done are sort of directed towards that. I looked at the original Undaunted, and they usually only have one objective. What they've done different in this one, you have two different ways you can win every fight.
Well, one objective that corresponds to many different terrain squares. It's not that there's one objective space that everyone needs to rush to. It's not a king of a hill. It's just the objective is to win by capturing victory objectives, and they may be the same or different for both sides, as opposed to Undaunted 2200, which has as a fallback, or murder a certain number of units. And in my experience, that is the victory condition that is going to work.
It's true. In all the games we played, that was the victory. But the other ones were very close as well, I think.
That is true. They were closer than I expected them to be, yes.
Other changes that sort of lead into that is that the two sides are very asymmetrical.
Extremely asymmetrical.
Unlike
yes.
they are in normal Undaunted. The
yeah.
regular Undaunted is mostly concentrated on World War II, so you normally have these humans versus those humans.
Yeah,
which
rifles,
makes them very
rifles and scouts, and they're roughly the same. Stalingrad, as the campaign progresses, really accentuates the asymmetry. North Africa starts out very asymmetric because it's the long-range desert group against Italian regulars. But yes, by and large, the earlier Undaunteds have been much more symmetrical.
Which is good and bad. Good, because you know exactly what your opponent has. You know what
yes.
his units can do. You know which units you need to concentrate on. Because only some units can take control, which is how you get objective points. So you know you need to that unit just moved into objective. I need to focus on it because I know that unit can control. Not so clear in Callisto.
Yes. In Undaunted Callisto, for example, some of the minor units are Rippers. Some of them are Blasters. Which of these two are the ones that take command of objectives? Well, it's the Rippers, of course, because they rip open the... I don't get it. After several games in a row of Undaunted, I was still trying to wrap my head around which unit did what.
Yeah, there's two units that do control on the
yes,
weapon side. That's,
there is true.
It, yeah.
But Blasters don't, but
no.
Rippers do. And Rippers are sort of the base frontline infantry. And the fact that they're called Rippers is a little counterintuitive. And then there are the mechs. All the mechs do very different things. Some of the mechs can scout. Some of them can't. Some of them do direct fire. Some of them won't, unless they're at a very, very short range. And so just navigating all these different possibilities, even as the user, whether you have experience with Undaunted or not, this may be one of those cases where you're probably better off if you don't have experience with the previous Undaunted games, because you're trying to find analogs. Sometimes there is a close analog. Corpsec are riflemen. That's all there is to it. Very straightforward. Rippers are not. They are slightly different. And then on top of that, there are all these other weird infantry types that don't have analogs to the other Undaunted games. And mostly what I missed was the certainty of knowing what my opponent can do with any given card. I was constantly looking over at the card supplies of my opponent just to see what their units could do at any given time.
So this also leads into the fact that in normal Undaunted, the only things that usually changed would be the terrain and where the objectives were and what you had to do. In this one, there's a lot of little extra rules. So like in normal Undaunted, I'm sure we can just set up the map and not have to refer to the rule book again, because the units do what they do and you're good to go. In Callisto, there are like buildings and there's pit traps and there's doors and there's different elevations. So there's different things that you might need to like brush up on every time you pull it out.
I liked the elevation. So the elevation is the one big core rules change to Undaunted Callisto that felt as clean, as approachable, as memorable, and really consequential as some of the other design decisions in past Undaunted games. If you are firing up elevation, you use D8s. If you're firing at equivalent elevation, you use D10s. If you're firing down elevation, you use D12s. No extra line of sight rules, no special rules about how to move up and down elevations. There are some other contexts where that matters, but that's not due to the core elevation rules. And it does provide a great bit of risk reward. If you spend the time exposing yourself to that withering degree of fire, you have a reason to gain ground, and then you're going to benefit from it for the rest of the scenario unless you're dislodged. And on top of that, This, again, relates to some of the asymmetry that I find difficult to remember, but at least it led to some good, interesting gameplay decisions. There are some short-range mechs that have weapons that force units to move, so you can shunt them off of the high ground and do things of that nature. I really liked the elevation system, and I think it's the kind of thing that I wish could be backported to previous Undaunteds. There's a reason why they won't, though, and that's because the previous Undaunteds only come with D10s. They don't come with D8s or D12s.
Yeah, on that note, this is the first one that where 10s aren't automatic hits.
Yes,
and that's the other Undaunted things, if you rolled a 10, it would have been an automatic hit because you only rolled D10s. Even in this one, 8s and 12s don't mean automatic hits anymore either. And the other note, like you said, Pulse is another new ability that lets you push units around. What makes it extra nasty is the fact that not only does it push, but it also does damage.
Yes.
Whereas, you know, suppression is only suppression and it doesn't damage. This pushes and does damage.
Absolutely.
Which is nasty. Doors, like I've already talked about, there's these, it's an interesting sort of mechanism where there's a sort of a console that you have to be at to do an action, and it will open the door, open some doors, and they will stay open for the rest of the game. You can't close them again. You cannot shoot through doorways. And most of the time, I haven't seen all of the maps or studied all of the maps, but most of the time, mechs and vehicles can't enter through doors because usually it's like an inside part of a building.
Yeah, because mechs don't use their inside voice.
They do not.
It's true.
There's also bridges, which are kind of interesting because you have no line of sight for things that are underneath the bridges. And usually they're very rickety, so mechs usually can't cross them as well. I thought they were kind of interesting. There's also a new ability called Pathfinder, which is a different way to scout where you don't actually move, but it sort of scouts out the area in front of you. Scouting sort of leans into another thing, if you're not familiar with Undaunted, is that you're going to have these fog of war, but in this case, they're called interference, and they're just sort of useless cards that are in your deck that you can only get rid of using your scout cards, and that's another sort of vicious trade-off. Do I really need to get move forward? And you can only move into areas that you've scouted, so am I going to scout forward, or am I going to use this scout to get rid of these interference cards so they don't hurt me in the future?
That's been another hallmark of the Undaunted series, that the quality of deck building, I think, is very high in terms of which units do I need to reinforce? Which units can I afford not to reinforce? Which units would reinforcing just cause bloat, and I would be perfectly happy to let them be pinned and useless in some contexts? When do I scout? How do I scout? How do I scout these things out? All those things are a lot of your solid traditional deck building elements, and I think the Undaunted series has done them extraordinarily well. So the solo system returns, in this case designed by David Tsirtse and David Bigby, and you had some experience with it.
I did. I tried it two ways, just because I was very much looking forward to this because I had solo. So I played with the solo rules as written. And they're not overly cumbersome, but the rule book is 90 pages long. That being said, each scenario has its own sort of section because, you know, the AI is going to act differently depending on what scenario it is.
Separate AI tables for every unit.
And when you go into the Board Game Geek forums, 90% of the questions are to try to clarify a lot of this solo terminology and how it works.
That's hardly unique to Undaunted. You'll find the same thing, for example, in Gloomhaven.
The second way I tried it was much better, and I had no problem with it. I just two-handed it. I have no problem playing both sides.
Yeah.
I don't have a problem of, you know, letting one side win over the other.
Right.
And it was great. I had no problem with it. It worked fantastic.
I'm of the same opinion, largely, about the solo system. It's a refinement in some ways over the solo system that was first introduced in Undaunted Reinforcements that gave solo versions of all the existing scenarios to Normandy and North Africa. It is a good thing that they put the AI charts in a book rather than across cards. It facilitates setup and is easy for reference. I wish the book had been spiral-bound, though, because you basically have to shatter the spine of that book so it lays flat while you're playing. I found the AI, though, especially in the scenarios of Undaunted 2200, to be borderline stupid. I tried it a couple times. The problem is that, as I said, in so many of these scenarios, there's a withering volume of fire that you're being subjected to, and the AI does not reinforce enough, and when it does reinforce, it reinforces randomly. If it is the case that you have two possible victory conditions, one of them is just murder, and the other victory condition is to grab territory that only one of your units is able to do, I am going to focus on that fragile unit that can only gain ground because I'm preventing you from doing either of your victory conditions, and I'm advancing one of mine in the process. And the AI just refused to reinforce with appropriate zeal at all. Like, it was just, the margin was so huge, it was borderline trivial, and I felt like I was just wasting my time as a consequence with that. I agree with you that a two-handed system is much, much better if you're inclined to play Undaunted solo.
On the flip side, Clisto has a four-player mode. I did read through it very quickly. I can see how it would work. What it does is sort of halves the number of initiative phases, and every scenario of Callisto, both sides have sort of two groupings of units. You have, you know, squad one and squad two, and they all consist of their different sort of units. And so you just split those up between the players, and one person is nominated as the captain. They get to draw four cards. The other player only draws three, so only the captain plays initiative. And then it goes back and forth. So you just know that if you won initiative, the other side's going to automatically, technically, sort of win initiative for the next round, even though you're just going back and forth for four rounds and then doing initiative again.
Yeah, there's a kind of interesting element where you can buy cards for your teammate, not entirely unlike Xenoshift. But all told, it is mostly just taking an existing scenario and chopping it up into half the fun.
Exactly. Now, let's just quickly talk about the mechs, because I'm interested in what you think about the mechs. How the mech works is much like the vehicles do, is that there is a mech on the board, and you're sort of staffing it, is how it's going to sort of act. Because you're going to buy gunners for it, you're going to buy nav people, and you have your commander. And you played mostly with the mech, so I'm interested to see what you thought. It seems as though there was a little bit of frustration with it.
There's a little bit of frustration by virtue of the fact that, number one, some of the scenarios are designed very specifically to make sure that the mechs don't get to do anything until about midway through the scenario, so they just stand at the deployment zone and shoot until the way is clear. And number two, every mech has basically three sets of abilities. There's what the commander can make them do, there's what the gunner can make them do, and there's what the navigator can make them do. And even with all this complexity, Undaunted 2200 is not a very complicated game. But compared to the level of asymmetry and the level of weirdness, stretching past all the other versions of Undaunted, it is by a factor of at least two twice as much more complicated and in-depth and full of corner cases. And so I would be in these positions of saying, okay, what is it that I need the mech to do? Can the mech do that? Check three different sets of cards. Okay, it can do it if I buy the navigator. Okay, the navigator does that for the mech. And yeah, it's reasonably coherent across that. The navigator's going to do the scout stuff, and the gunner's going to do the gunning stuff. But then the gunner can't fire the gun that the commander can fire. The special gun can only be fired by the commander, and it's the one that's limited in range. Okay, fine, what? And honestly, then I just found that it was a case of just trying to remember how the thing worked more often than not. I love mechs. I love stompy robots. I don't think that Undaunted 2200 did a particularly good job with them.
Yeah, because you're still limited to your three cards that you're going to play. And so did you get the actual mech cards that you want? And all of the mech cards are almost, you know, two or three initiatives. So even if you got a mech card that you didn't need at this particular point, then it's not going to be a great initiative card for you either.
Yes.
And so sometimes you're bloating your deck with cards that you don't need, and you can get rid of them eventually, but you've wasted time on them now, and it's very circumstantial.
And there's this odd, thematically coherent, and possibly balanced, but nonetheless personally unsatisfying, this is very much a personal preference thing, where the mechs are either invincible or super fragile. They're invincible almost at range. Because generally speaking, especially in the early scenarios, the miners do not have ranged attacks that can damage mechs. On the other hand, the miners, as a rule, if they get into the same space as a mech, can chew it up like crazy. It becomes almost trivial.
You just cut their legs off.
Yeah, pretty much. Now, this makes perfect sense, and, you know, talk about, you know, unsupported armor and infantry, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, I get it. The problem is that it creates a disincentive for the mechs to move and do anything interesting. And so consequently, I both for the reasons of keeping it simple and trackable in my head, and for the reasons of the fact that I'm conservative, most of the times I just left the mechs in the deployment zone taking pot shots at range.
On the other hand, the breakers get vehicles, and the drill just seems just generically more interesting to use because it just seems to be able to do stuff that's good all the time. I.e. it just moves and scouts at the same time. And not only that, it gets to bring units that are ready with them, which I think is just usually always good as opposed to the mechs.
The drill, I thought, was both more useful and more interestingly useful. I really liked how the drill worked, frankly.
And it gives extra cover to the units that are with it.
So what is your sort of top-line summary of Undaunted 2200 Callisto, Walker?
I very much enjoyed it. I think, for me, it is the best Undaunted.
It does
a lot of the things that normal Undaunted did. Every card you have has a name, so every member in that squad has a certain name.
That's been true since the beginning.
It has. I'm just saying it's the same. I get that out of it, where you're invested in your side. They all have different powers, and I like how the setup is a little faster. Yes, overall, I just enjoy the setting as well too. Science fiction, mechs, buildings, dystopian.
I like science fiction. I like this science fiction setting. And I even had some problems with the way that the war was framed in Undaunted Normandy. So I was inclined to approve of the setting and a lot of the framing. As it is, I don't enjoy the asymmetry. I don't enjoy many, if not most, of the gameplay changes. And frankly, I think all told, this is my least favorite of the Undaunted series. I don't know if it's a good starting point. Like, what would you say?
No, I was thinking about this earlier today, and just because of those extra things, like the height and the doors and the bridges and all this extra stuff that you're tacking on, plus the fact that all the units are different, so it'd be very hard for sort of helping the other person out, you know, type thing. I don't think it's a good entry point for Undaunted.
I think, sadly, because it's the most expensive product, I think the best entry point is probably Stalingrad, because it introduces the asymmetry and it introduces the new elements in a very organic and satisfying campaign-driven way. Undaunted Normandy is also a great starting point, but it is comparatively less textured in terms of unit differentiation. But the balance of unit differentiation and the pace at which it's introduced, I think, is borderline perfect in Stalingrad. And then North Africa is, I think, sort of the weird one out, because it deals with vehicles in a very different way. And in an interesting way, but it's also just very strange. And Battle of Britain is just very different in terms of how it plays and feels, while nonetheless using the same card system.
So I agree. Stalingrad is the way to go, because not only, like you said, does it introduce things slowly so you understand it, it just leaves the door open to go as far as you want.
It's true. That's a good point. Well put. So all told, for me, I enjoy Undaunted 2200, but I don't think it is one of the stronger games in the system, despite the fact that it is a system that overall I continue to absolutely adore. And it still hits all those deck-building gameplay design notes that have been so well executed and internalized throughout the series.
I will be keeping my copy. That is Undaunted Callisto 2200 by David Thompson and Trevor Benjamin.
Well, that's going to do it for this week. Thank you so much for joining us for So Very Wrong About Games. Please take care of yourself, take care of your hobby, and as always, thank your rules explainer. Happy Fat Bear Week, everybody.
Peace!
You've been listening to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about board games produced by Michael Walker and edited by Mark McNeil. You can find all our information at sowronggames.com. Special thanks to What Does It Eat for allowing us to use their most excellent song, FOS, as our intro. You can find them at whatdoesiteat.com. We hope to see you again soon, and as always, try to be right, but remember, you're so very wrong.